Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, mastodon jaw unearthed in Orange County family's backyard. Researchers were alerted to the jaw-dropping discovery in the hamlet of Scotchtown. They spent about 2.5 days digging at the home, uncovering more bone fragments and a complete adult jaw. We'll speak to one of the researchers from SUNY Orange about the stunning ancient find. Science Stories with Joe Johnson, our resident science guy, looks back on his top science stories of the year. Chasing Tradition, Square Dancing in the Catskills, the latest episode of Cats Cast, the Catskills podcast, explores the longstanding tradition of square dancing at a Catskills family farm. And a new voice you'll be hearing on Radio Catskill in the new year. Coming up, but first the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The funeral plans for former President Jimmy Carter have been announced. His state funeral will be held in Washington, D.C. on Thursday, January 9th. President Biden has ordered federal agencies to close on the 9th. Carter will be laid to rest in a private ceremony in his hometown of Plains, Georgia. South Korea's acting president has ordered improvements to the nation's airline operation system. This follows Sunday's plane crash that killed 179 people. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Seoul that two crew members were the only survivors.
At a government disaster response meeting, acting President Choi Sang-mok ordered the Transportation Ministry to re-examine the nation's airline operation systems and make necessary improvements. The government has launched an emergency safety inspection of six local airlines using the Boeing 737-800, which was involved in the crash. Personnel from the U.S. National Transportation Safety Board, the Federal Aviation Administration, and Boeing are assisting with the investigation into the crash. South Korea is in a week-long national period of mourning. Seoul usually welcomes the new year with a bell-ringing ceremony. Performances this year will be replaced by a moment of silence. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
Last weekend, the Israeli military shut down the last major hospital functioning in northern Gaza. NPR's Ayab Batraoui reports the hospital was the last remaining lifeline for many Palestinians in northern Gaza.
Israel says this hospital was being used by Hamas, and in the raid that shut it down over the weekend, they detained 240 suspected militants in the area, some of whom they believe were involved in last year's October 7th attack on Israel. Israel describes this raid as swift and covert, but among those detained is Dr. Abu Safiya.
NPR's Ayab Batraoui reports he is the hospital's director. He was also detained by the Israeli military. Stocks opened higher on this final trading day of 2024. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 200 points in early trading.
Stocks are ending the year with double-digit gains. The S&P 500 index is up more than 20% from a year ago, while the tech-heavy NASDAQ jumped nearly 30%. Crude oil prices rose overnight. Retail gasoline prices are also up slightly. AAA says the average price of regular gas climbed to just over $3.04 a gallon. That's still about 7 cents less than this time last year. New figures out of China show that country's manufacturing sector is still growing, but just barely. Government efforts to stimulate the world's second-largest economy appear to be falling short. Stocks were lower in Shanghai, but up in Hong Kong overnight. Markets in Tokyo and Seoul were closed for the New Year's holiday. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now up about 180 points. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The Pentagon says U.S. forces have fired airstrikes on multiple targets in Yemen. U.S. Central Command says the targets are held by Houthi rebels. They have been firing missiles at Israel and attacking commercial shipping in the Red Sea. The Eastern European nation of Moldova is facing an energy crisis. Tomorrow, Russia is expected to stop shipping natural gas to Europe. That's because a deal to keep Russian gas flowing to Europe is expiring. Other nations are finding some energy workarounds. But people in the small nation of Moldova are concerned they'll lose power and heat as winter sets in. Celebrations to mark the start of 2025 are underway. Christina Kukulia reports in Australia, tens of thousands of people attended New Year's events.
The biggest and most spectacular New Year's celebration in Australia was around the iconic Sydney Harbour, where thousands of spectators had queued for hours for the best viewing spots. The most popular spots had views of the massive fireworks show that lit up the Harbour Bridge and Sydney Opera House. Melbourne and other Australian cities also marked the arrival of 2025 with huge fireworks displays. In New Zealand, wet and windy weather caused the cancellation of New Year's Eve events in Christchurch. However, Auckland put on an impressive show to become the first major city to bring in 2025. For NPR News, I'm Christina Kukolia in Melbourne, Australia.
Forecasters say a stream of Arctic air will blanket much of the U.S. this week. The frigid temperatures will stretch from the northern Rockies to the east coast. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, imagine this. You're out in your backyard and you're raking the leaves and all of a sudden you kind of notice something. That's what happened to the owner of an Orange County property where a significant discovery was made, a complete mastodon jaw, the first such find in New York State in over 11 years. The owner of the Scotchtown property in the Hudson Valley where the jaw was found had noticed two teeth concealed by a plant when he was tending to his yard and then dug up two additional teeth just inches underground. The resident told Spectrum News Hudson Valley, quote, "When I found the teeth and examined them in my hands, I knew they were something special and decided to call in the experts." Those experts were researchers from the New York State Museum and SUNY Orange who unearthed the fossils. Radio Catskill's Patricio Rubio spoke to one of those experts, Dr. Corey Harris, chair of SUNY Orange's Behavioral Science Department, Sciences Department, about the ancient find.
So what happened was on, I think it was a Friday morning in September where between my classes, a couple of property owners came into the college with two mastodon teeth. And they had previously that week just been doing yard work in their backyard. And they ran across these and they pulled them out and they clearly knew that they had something pretty unusual there. And they just wanted to come to the college to get some kind of verification and maybe get some guidance as to next steps. That's how I intersected with these mastodon teeth.
Wow, it's amazing that they found it right in there, literally back in their backyard.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing that SUNY Orange is no stranger to mastodon. There's also was one and found a couple of years ago in Newburgh, right?
Yeah, there's been mastodons found all over the county, and I don't have my timeline with me for all the mastodon finds, but I think that the last one found was actually in Middletown, the Middletown area also. Okay. So Orange County has been a hotbed for mastodons since George Washington was tromping around the county.
Right. And you're the chair of SUNY Orange's Behavioral Science Department, professor of anthropology and sociology.
Yeah, my primary training is in archaeology, so that's why these folks ended up with me, just because I have experience doing excavations and such. But because the material was, because it was mastodon teeth, after I met with the property owners, I reached out to Bob Franek at the New York State Museum. He works as a vertebrate paleontologist there. So he's got some expertise that I don't have and resources that I don't have. So I wanted to connect with him so that we could do the best we could for this material coming out of their backyard.
Let's go back a little bit. What was your first reaction when you realized that when they brought to you the mastodon teeth?
It was really exciting because while the history of, again, Orange County, there's been a lot of mastodons that have been found over the years, but I personally have not been involved in any of that. To actually see newly discovered mastodon teeth and to know, and when you see mastodon teeth, if you've seen them once before, you're going to know what they are. So just to see them there was really exciting because many times when somewhat often people will bring things into my office or send me pictures because I teach archaeology, wanting to know what these objects are. And the property owners or the discoverers of the items often are really invested in it being something. And more often than not, the material they bring in is not something. It's just an unusual looking rock or something like that. But in this case, there was absolutely no ambiguity. These were full-on mastodon teeth. So it was just really exciting to be involved with that.
And it wasn't just the teeth. It was also the jawbone that was found with it, right?
Yeah. So what happened was when the property owners brought in the teeth and I contacted the state museum, we went out to the property the next week and poked around in the yard where the teeth had been found. And fairly quickly, we saw evidence that there were two more teeth still in the ground. And at that point, the decision was made to do a limited excavation prior to winter to recover the teeth. But as we went down, the teeth were pretty obviously embedded in something beyond just ground. Like when you grab them, they would not wiggle. So we excavated down, and those two teeth were still embedded in the jaw of the mastodon. So the jaw was, we dug down and were able to recover the entire jaw, which is now up at the New York State Museum in Albany.
Wow, it's amazing. Now, with the mastodon jaw being in Middletown, what could it tell us? What can it tell us about the Ice Age and the region's prehistoric ecosystem?
It could tell us quite a bit. One of the things that, again, is valuable about the museum participating is they have access to analyses that I wouldn't have at SUNY Orange. So they'll do things like basic radiocarbon dating, or at least send it out to labs to get radiocarbon dating. But then they can also, we'll be doing analysis of the chemical composition of the bones to see what it was eating, which that clearly is going to give you a window onto life probably about 13,000 years ago or so, and what the environment of this place was like.
Oh, it's just amazing. Now, you mentioned, I saw in the press release, you mentioned that of a potential summer field experience for some of the students, for your students. What that might look like, and how can the students get involved in this?
Okay, yeah, I'm hopeful about this. It's not completely set yet, but the hope would be that the students could, because we have a course on our catalog where students can sign up for 3 credits, but they spend 5 weeks doing excavation. They would just register for the class. They would actually need to come talk to me first, but they would register for the class, and it would be likely over June, where we'd spend 4 or 5 weeks out on site excavating further. Because like I mentioned earlier, this jaw, we recovered it based on a fairly small excavation. And so there are hopes that there might be more of the skeletal remains out there, but we just don't know yet because we just didn't have the time to explore further. But even what more, I'm excited about being able to provide some of our students the opportunity to be involved in a process like this. Because I referenced earlier, I've been teaching 25 years now, but I was really excited to see these teeth. So I just think it'd be so valuable for students who are new to higher education to be able to participate in that process as well.
Now, in one of the articles I've read about the teeth, they say that more than 150 mastodon fossils have been found across New York State. 1/3 of them come from Orange County, according to the museum. Why do you think this area is such a sort of a hotspot for fossils?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I don't know all of it, but part of it was an ancient environment that was attractive to these animals, and a kind of forest that was around here around probably 13, 14,000 years ago. It was full of pines and stuff, and that's what it seems like the mastodons tended to eat. This valley, the Wallkill Valley, as the glaciers were retreating north, was a big lake, and a changing lake and ponds and such. And so it was an attractive environment for the mastodons and other life. But also ponds and lake edges are also places where muddy conditions could contribute to a mastodon dying. And then also being relatively quickly covered over by sediment. And then that helps to preserve the material for to today. So I think it's the ancient environment, both for attractiveness while the animals were living, but also creating conditions for preservation of the animals once they die. And then too, part of it, I think Orange County has in the past 250 years, it's got a history of human occupation that is medium intensity, because we're not New York City where it's been built over and built over, but we're not in the middle of nowhere where nothing has been, you know, touched. Because a lot of the finds of mastodons happen not because people are looking for mastodons, but because people are just doing things like farming or building a new road or some other kind of development activity. I think Orange County maybe hits a sweet spot that we're not overdeveloped, but we've got enough development that we've encountered these many of these remains.
It's just amazing to see history come alive and see this in person, I'm sure. Are there any sort of plans for ongoing collaboration either with the State Museum for future excavations at the site?
Yeah, like that field class I was mentioning to you earlier, that would be done hand in hand because the museum would be the lab and the spot for analysis. Any of the material that would be recovered, the property owner has already made has made at least an agreement with the museum that the mastodon material would go to the museum at least for initial analysis and conservation. We would maintain that for sure. I would see the future project that we're trying to put together would be a full on collaboration between my college and the New York State Museum.
Wow. Now, do you know that the final place for these jewel will come back to SUNY Orange or will stay at the State Museum?
It's really early to tell because it's still, even though it was a full jaw, there were definitely parts that were in fragments and it's being pieced together slowly. And my guess is that it will be a while that it'll be at the, once it's fully conserved, it'll be at the museum on display for a while. And then it may come to SUNY Orange on loan for some periods. But I do think that the museum is probably the best place for it long term, because doing what museums do, you want to provide this record for not just today, but for the future. And because that's what that institution is dedicated to, I feel that's the best place for the jaw long term.
And just to go back in the beginning, the mastodon that SUNY Orange has is called Sugar, and it was dug up in 1972 near the fields of Warwick-Chester border. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. It's amazing that we've got a mastodon in one of our college buildings.
Yeah, it is. It's just, I love history. I love what you do. You're archaeologists. I'm just amazed by you folks with everything that's done and just bringing up history alive directly from the ground. Let's say if a person listened to this and they found something who may stumble something unusual in their backyards, what did she do? Did she do exactly what these folks did? Either come to the college to find out exactly what this is?
Yes, I would definitely encourage that. The property owners that initially found this mastodon, I really feel a debt of gratitude to them because it's their property. They own the mastodon. They could do whatever they wanted with that mastodon. But the fact that they brought it to me and then I was able to connect with the New York State Museum, we're going to be able to provide much more just knowledge and information and just make it more interesting and enriching for everybody, them included. They've been great. They've been very active and involved in this process. But it really multiplies what can be the value of this mastodon. Because unfortunately, I think there's probably mastodon teeth sitting in some people's garages in Orange County. That they found them, they thought they were cool, and then they just held on to them and they never went any further with it. And to me, I think that's a real missed opportunity, because one thing I would want to really encourage is if somebody found something like this, no one's going to, quote, go in and take it away from them. We would always act as active partners if somebody wanted to pursue further scientific investigation of the material. Going back to your question, yes, absolutely. If somebody found something interesting, I would encourage them to reach out to the local college or the New York State Museum, either to connect with people who have a framework of what to do next.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Dr. Corey, Dr. Harris, anything else before we leave?
I think that's about it. I do like to end on that note of that I think this was a case of both the community property owners and the college and the museum all doing what ideally, I think I would wish everybody would do. We're doing so far. I think this has been a great example of community and state county institution partnerships.
All right. We're talking to Dr. Corey Harris, chair of the SUNY Orange's Behavioral Sciences Department, professor of anthropology and sociology. Thank you so much for talking to me about this mastodon jaw and teeth that were found right here in our state of New York.
And thanks to Patricia.
Thank you very much, too.
Thanks to Patricia Overbio for that. And keep your eyes open when you're out in the backyard. We'll take a break. And when we come back, Joe Johnson and Science Stories. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Lakshmi Singh. What's special about public radio is it doesn't just keep you informed. It reminds us of our shared humanity, even at our darkest hours, like with the story of an artist couple who make beautiful spaces for communities to grieve.
We found that people will usually stop by and just feel a little bit more open and willing to talk and share.
Help us make room for light in the dark. Donate to the station today.
Make your year-end donation now at wjffradio.org.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, independent grassroots global news. Our reporting includes breaking daily news headlines and in-depth interviews with people on the front lines of the world's most pressing issues. People speaking for themselves, providing unique and sometimes provocative perspectives on global events. Democracy Now!, weekdays at noon, right here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, as nearly half the world's population headed to the polls this year, politics grabbed many of the headlines. But scientists and the natural world also managed to attract the public's attention. Our resident science guy, Joe Johnson, takes a look at some of his top science stories of the year, including the sun and the solar eclipse, the rise of artificial intelligence, and the humble fruit fly.
Now, many people are familiar with the common fruit fly, Drosophila melanogaster. And what scientists have done is they've created a complete map and model brain, all 140,000 neurons of which, in a computer model. Now, the fruit fly is well known to biology students, especially students of genetics education, because they only have four pairs of chromosomes, and their phenotype is really easy to observe. The color of their eyes, the size of their wings and something, etc. Now, I personally raised generations of fruit flies when I was a biology student. They're a really well-known and really well-studied species. A team from Howard Hughes Medical Institute and literally dozens of other labs around the world have mapped the brain, and it's really interesting the way they did this. They took fruit fly brains, which are the size of a tiny little seed. I mean, think how small a fruit fly is. The brain is that much smaller. And they took sections of the brain. They sliced the brain up, about 7,000 slices per brain, each slice being about 40 nanometers in thickness. And a nanometer is a billionth of a meter. So these were tiny little slices. They then took these tiny slices, imaged them with an electron microscope, producing over, in all, for the entire experiment, about 21 billion images, and it took up about 100 terabytes of data. And they scanned them with an electron microscope and then assembled the slices in a computer to create a model of the brain showing all of the different types of synapses. There's about 8,000 different types of neurons, I should say, not synapses. And they assembled them in the computer, and they created this amazing map. Now, they wanted to check how accurate it was, and so they employed gamers. About 10,000 gamers worldwide used a website called Flywire, and they basically proofread the brain. They went through each neuron. They went through all the connections, all the synapses, and they basically proofread what the computer did.
It was a crowdsourced thing.
It was.
And 21 million images that this map was built from. Mm-hmm. And then these gamers helped.
They proofread it.
Proofread it. That's amazing.
If you go to Flywire, if you look it up online, some of the images are just astounding. They've color-coded the neurons, and it's just amazingly beautiful.
Flywire, pun intended there.
Yes. Now, they wanted to test the model. And so they knew what some parts of the brain did. Like they knew the part of the brain that was sensory input for sugar taste. So they activated those neurons in the model. And what happened was the neurons fired up into the brain. They activated whole nets within the brain, whole little networks within the brain, which then activated the motor neurons for the proboscis, the kind of combination mouth part of the fruit fly, and that extended and started trying to feed in the model. That, you know, they could see that that would have happened if it was a real fruit fly. So the model works. It's not just a fancy thing in the computer. It really works.
And what does this help us understand in terms of the human brain?
Sure. Why is this important? Well, first of all, how they want to know how the brain works. They know generally how the brain works, but not at the neuron by neuron level. You know, what each section processes, what's connected to what. Now, for humans, fruit flies share about 60% of our genes with humans. Okay, mostly metabolic stuff, how, you know, your cells work and stuff like that. But many shared genes are for neurological disorders like Parkinson's disease and other neurodegenerative disorders. And so by understanding how they work, we may be able to treat or even prevent these diseases in humans.
It's amazing that they share so much of the same DNA as humans do. The humble fruit fly.
The humble fruit fly. Zebrafish, which is another model that they're going to be working on, shares about 70% of the genes with humans. So I think there's a couple in what next. First of all, they're going to test the model. They're going to make sure that the model works. They're going to refine that. They're going to look at a mouse brain. I think that's next on the horizon. And then because that's a mammal brain, a little more similar to ours. And then, as I said, the zebrafish.
Wow, that's great. Really
it
cool.
Is. Very, very cool stuff.
Now, something else kind of cool but also a bit daunting, perhaps frightening to some, is AI, artificial intelligence.
Artificial intelligence.
A lot about that the last year. What was it about AI that sort of caught your attention?
Well, I've been a big fan of sci-fi for a long time. And so when they started talking about artificial intelligence, back in 2020 is when this really kind of popped up into the public's awareness. And what AI is, by the way, is it's software that can think and act like humans. It can learn, reason, and act in a way that would normally require a human intelligence. And the powerful thing about AI is that it can analyze vast amounts of data at a very deep level, and it can recognize patterns in that data. Now, AI is not sci-fi. It's not, you know, it's here and now. Most of us use it every day. I've used it already today. If you turn on a streaming service and it recommends content, whether it's a video or some music to you, that's an AI working. Voice interactive technologies like Siri, or when you call up the drugstore and you renew your prescription and you have to go through the phone tree and tell it what you need, give it the number, confirm it, etc. That's an AI. And even like some games like chess playing games are a form of AI. Now, there's three types of AI. The stuff that I've talked about so far is what's called narrow AI. It can perform a very specific task. What they're working on now, the second type, is artificial general intelligence, and this is considered to be human-level intelligence. They're not quite there. The engineers are still working on it. They say they're approaching it. Now, when you pair this with a large language model, which is a kind of a communications between the computer and humans that has been trained on a lot of data, they can communicate with you in a very human way. It's going to get to a point where you're going to have a conversation with an AI, and you're not even going to know you're talking to a computer.
Which is the scary part for some folks.
It is. Now, there's four big ones by market share. Grok, which is all about each of the AIs I found. This is something I found very interesting. Each of the AI models deals with like a different area. Their engineers have looked at different things. Like, for instance, Grok is all about scientific inquiry. And the funny thing about it is that their engineers say that they have built a sense of humor into it.
Mm.
That I would like to see.
Mm-hmm.
the second one is Optimal, which is all about image processing and optimization. Drift, which is conversational customer service, when you call up and you have to talk to a computer for customer service. And the one that most people have heard of from OpenAI is GPT-4. This is more creative, writes stories, writes songs. It's what's called a generative AI.
And so, you know, artificial intelligence or AI kind of came of age in the last year in mm-hmm. some ways. Do you see these kind of progress in the coming years as helping in science? As you know, well, there have been some revelations made with the use of AI.
Absolutely. I think there's huge implications, not just in science, but healthcare, education, robotics, business. Personally, I think AI would be great for air traffic control because I don't think it would make some of the mistakes that are made. But anyway, I definitely think that there is it's going to keep going. There's nothing that's going to stop this. The third type is what's called artificial superintelligence, and this is an intelligence that is thought of that it will surpass human intelligence. We don't even know what that's going to look like, but it's been described as an inexhaustible, hyper-intelligent entity with the ability to process and analyze any amount of data. Now, that to me is scary science fiction stuff. Don't worry about that, though, because the computers that we need to do something like that don't even exist today. They will have to build those computers.
Right.
Now, with anything, you got to think about benefits and risks. The benefits of AI, I think, are decision-making and problem-solving. We can use this in science. We can use this in medicine. We can use this in a lot of areas. The risks, well, it's going to automate a lot of stuff, and there's going to be some job losses. The thing that I wonder about is, can you build ethics into an AI? How can they program that in? One of the other risks or perils is hyper-realistic content. Deep fakes and scams are, we're already seeing those, where people are scamming people by using the voice of loved ones. And some people even think of this as an existential threat to the human race. That's where the sci-fi scary stuff comes in.
Yeah, there's a natural sort of pushback, I think, because especially when you talk about the creative side of it, people think, oh, well, that's, you know, taking the place of humans being creative.
Right, right.
Sometimes people can't distinguish between the two. I mean, it's gotten so advanced in some places that makes it harder to understand.
I think they're working on a law that will, where they will have to identify AI content, AI-generated content.
Label it, yeah.
Some of the videos I've seen, some of the video games, some of the clips that have made are just so hyper-realistic. They're amazing.
Now, we will find out from the Academy Awards in a few months, you know, best picture of the year. But for this year, your nominee and your winner for the science story of the year is The Sun.
Yes, the year,
the year
of the Sun.
Of the Sun.
The Year of the Sun. Absolutely.
Why was that?
Well, there was so much in the news and so much in science about this year about the sun. A couple of things. First of all, we have reached what's called solar max. You may remember, you may know that the sun has roughly an 11-year cycle of solar activity, sunspots, flares, coronal mass ejections. This is, by the way, has been tracked since the 1600s. Galileo was the first person to observe sunspots. He used his telescope to project an image of the sun onto a white sheet, and he noticed that there were dark spots on the surface of the sun. So they started counting them. And so we've had data since literally 1600s. You know, 400 plus years. So solar max occurs every 11 years. And the last one was in 2013. So do the math. Mm-hmm. For the last year or so, we've noticed a real increase in solar activity, more sunspots, more flares and coronal mass ejections. And according to NASA and NOAA, we've reached max sometime around the end of October. Now, this is not a peak. It's not like you hit a peak and now it's going to go down. This is kind of like a little plateau on the top. We don't know how long solar max is going to last. It could last a year. So all of this increased activity, all the solar flares, all the coronal mass ejections and the auroras that we've seen, we could be in for a year of this stuff. That's the upside. The you know, the auroras are the cool part about it.
Well, that's the northern lights that more people could see because of the solar max that happened in October.
Right. That went it went so far south, down into North Carolina and even into Florida. I have a report. I read a report of people being able to see the aurora. It's rare for people this far south where we are in Liberty to see the solar to see the auroras. But they can be seen. We saw them twice this year at my house, May 10th and October 10th. And we could be in for more.
And in May, there were kind of like solar storms.
Right, right. The sun is, this time of year at solar max, or this time within the cycle of solar max, the sun is firing off flares and coronal mass ejections all over the place. It's just that they're rarely pointed exactly at the Earth. I've seen animations that show them, you know, shooting out beyond the other side of the sun and above the Earth and below the Earth. But when they impact with the Earth, they cause the auroras. And the stronger the coronal mass ejection, the stronger the geomagnetic storm it creates, and the stronger the aurora, and the farther south it will go.
And then, of course, there was the great eclipse that happened in April, which you got a chance to go and view.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, this was amazing. It was the second one I've seen. We went down to Tennessee in 2017. I think I've said this before, to see the eclipse at my brother-in-law's house. And it was a beautiful sunny day, and it was otherworldly. Think of a clear blue sky, gorgeous day, and you look up, and there's a black hole in the sky where the sun is supposed to be. It's pretty amazing, amazing. But this one, you know, here in Liberty, you can see about 95% of the sun covered. You have to be under what's called the zone of totality, which is the actual inner shadow of the moon as it passes across the face of the Earth. I think it started down in Mexico, went up through the Northeast, went up through the Midwest, rather, came up through the Northeast, and then went out over Newfoundland, out into the Atlantic Ocean, into the North Atlantic. We traveled up to Oswego County. We were at the Salmon River Reservoir, And it was, once again, otherworldly. Yeah, though we had clouds. We had some high clouds. We were there the day before, and it was beautiful. But the day of the eclipse, we had some clouds, and we saw the eclipse just start, and then the clouds rolled in. And we hung in there, and just as it reached totality, the clouds parted. We saw totality happen. I saw the diamond ring effect, where you just see a little tiny bit of the sun, and it lit the moon, and it looks like a diamond ring. And Bailey's beads, where the sun is actually shining through valleys on the surface of the moon. And it was otherworldly. I don't know how to explain it other than that. But just a great year for all things solar.
The sun kind of had a moment in 2024.
The sun had a year in 2024. and like I said, Solar Max is still going on. So we're not going to see another eclipse. Actually, 2044 will be the next eclipse that will go through the United States. So if you can hang in there for like 20 years, you could see another total solar eclipse in the U.S. The next one is 2026, and it's just going to intersect the west coast of Iceland. And so if you want to take a trip up there, you can see a total solar eclipse.
Have you booked your trip yet?
I have not. My wife and I have talked about it. But if I will tell anybody who can travel to this and see one, it'll blow your mind. It was very cool.
Thank you so much, Joe Johnson with Science Stories, bringing us such great science stories all year long, and more to come in the new year.
More to come in the new year. Always my pleasure.
Happy New Year to you, sir.
Thank you. Same to you.
And Joe had a few honorable mentions for Science Stories of the Year he wanted to make sure we mentioned in there. Speaking of the sun, the Parker Solar Probe, which just survived a path that took it within 3.8 million miles of the sun. That's within the atmosphere of the sun. James Webb Space Telescope, looking farther and deeper into the past of our universe than ever possible before. The Europa Clipper, on the way to explore the moon of Jupiter, which is the best bet for life elsewhere in our solar system. Starship finally sticking the landing in the quest for a truly reusable spacecraft. The lost Mayan city found by accident using laser scans. And last but not least, our extinct cousins, the Neanderthals. We're learning more every day about them. And of course, more science stories to come from Joe Johnson in the new year. But we'll take a break now. And when we come back, chasing tradition, square dancing in the Catskills. It's the latest episode of Cats Cast, the Catskills podcast. We'll hear about it next. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, a conversation with Adam Moss, widely considered the best magazine editor of his generation.
There would be these story meetings, and people would cry.
Moss, the editor, has now written a book.
It's so hard. It's the dialogue in your head that was driving me completely crazy and why I never was a writer in the first place.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. This afternoon at 1 o'clock on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, before we end the year, one last check-in with Brett Berry of CatsCast, the Catskills podcast. The latest episode explores a long-standing tradition of square dancing at a family home and barn in Ashokan. Hosts Brett Berry and his production intern Olivia Sippel put on their dancing shoes and joined the fun, recording tales of traditional Catskills square dancing and the musicians who are passing it down to a new generation of enthusiasts. Joining us now to do-si-do a bit is Brett Berry. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Tim.
Yeah, tell us about how you discovered this tradition of square dancing at this family home in Ashokan.
Well, fortunately, I'm friendly with a woman by the name of Helen Chase, which is where the title of this episode comes from, Chasing Tradition, Square Dancing in the Catskills. Very clever, right?
Uh-huh.
And her parents started this tradition 50-something years ago at their family barn in Ashokan. And it continues. Even though that family barn has been sold to another family, the tradition continues, and that family has taken it up and continues with both families now inviting their friends and family to celebrate. And it all stems from even deeper traditions of square dancing in the Catskills that goes back much further.
And this, I mean, it's a great tradition. I didn't know that there was a tradition of square dancing in the Catskills. You and your production intern, as we mentioned, got to dance. What'd you think?
We had so much fun. everyone kind of just lets, there's no guard to let down, but everyone lets their guard down and just has a good time. And it's just a really interesting mix of people from all walks of life and ages, from little kids to old folks who join hands, maybe never having met each other before, and just have a great time. And the person who is kind of orchestrating this whole thing has a long history of fiddling and calling. Calling is kind of calling out what you're supposed to be doing. So even if you've never danced before, you're getting directions live throughout. And the man who did that has been also doing this for about 50 years. His name's Earl Pardini, and he's fantastic.
Well, before we promenade into your segment, just wanted to take a moment to thank you so much for letting us feature these episodes or portions of your podcast on Radio Chatskill. It's been so great to share these with our listeners because you have such a breadth of subjects that you cover in the Catskills: culture, history, local interviews, literature, the arts, things that we would not necessarily know about, and you're out there bringing it to us from Silver Hollow Audio and Catskills. So thank you so much, sir.
We feel really fortunate to be a part of the station in this way. So thank you, Tim, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. We will continue to sashay into 2025. You see me using some of your terms here. Thank you so much, and we'll take a listen to the latest episode of Cat's Cast from Brett Berry, and Happy New Year.
You too. Thanks, Tim.
In early November, an invitation appeared in my inbox from a friend, Helen Chase, for a square dance in a family barn on Teistenaik Mountain in Ashokan. I asked if I could bring a microphone, and our Up for Anything production intern, Olivia Sipple, and we were both warmly welcomed the day after Thanksgiving to the Chase family home and barn, now the Sparer home and barn, but the tradition continues. Friends and family have been dancing here for decades, with Earl Pardini, fiddler and caller, orchestrating the night. With a roaring fire in the fireplace and desserts on the sideboard, this barn had all the warmth and joviality of Mr. Fezziwig's place, as conceived by Charles Dickens in the 19th century. Before Olivia and I joined in the dancing, I asked Helen Chase, who'd sent that invitation, for a little background.
Our family lived in this house for about 50-some years, and now the Sparer family has been living here for about 9 years.
And when did this tradition begin with square dancing in this building? And has it always been this time of year?
We started doing the square dances at Thanksgiving because it was the time of my parents' wedding anniversary. So we would have Thanksgiving on the Thursday, and then we would always have a square dance on the Friday after Thanksgiving. We started off in the early years with records that had calling on the recording. And if it didn't have the calling on the recording, Dad would do the calling. Then we met Karen and Earl Pardini, very wonderful musician, Earl and his group. And we had a lot of musicians that got together, and Earl put them together, and we started having live calling and live bands. And we've done this now. We tried to figure out how many years Earl has been doing this with us and his band. I think it was 46 or 47 years.
When the other family moved in, did they inherit this event?
Yes. But we...
Willingly?
Willingly, very willingly, because they had been attending the square dances for quite a while.
Michael Sparer confirmed that their family was totally on board, taking the reins of this half-century tradition.
I'm Michael Sparer, and with my wife, we own this house and host the square dance.
You bought the house, the barn? And was it kind of a given that you'd be also inheriting the square dance?
For us, it was a gift, not a given. For years, we'd been coming to this house, you know, to attend the square dance, and we loved doing that. And it was an amazing tradition. And so for us, it was just kind of an honor to be able to continue the tradition. You know, I always feel like we kind of do it with Helen and the Trace family. But yeah, we're happy to host and keep it going.
Yeah. Seems like a good kickoff for the holiday season.
Yeah, it's an amazing kickoff for the holiday season and just a great tradition. It's a great tradition.
I checked in with a younger Chase whose memories of this tradition are lifelong, literally.
My name is Emmy Chase. I am the granddaughter of Catherine and Sherritt Chase, who formerly owned this house. And I've been doing this dance for 21 years now.
And you are 21.
I am 21, exactly, yes.
So what are your earliest memories of this experience?
I was wearing the biggest, fluffiest dress that I had, and I would wear my patent leather shoes, and I would dance around between everyone's legs and getting tripped on, but my dad would carry me on his shoulders, and we would dance around and do the square dance. So I basically have all of the moves memorized, and I'm a little bossy with people who don't know it as well.
Do you share this with friends at school? Do they think, like, what?
I would tell my friends in elementary school, and I grew up in suburban New Jersey, and they had no idea what a square dance was or even if it was a real thing. And it took a lot of years for my peers to appreciate square dancing. Yes.
Yeah. Some Catskills kids have a leg up in this regard. Back when my own kids were students at Phoenicia Elementary School, which sadly closed its doors this past year, none other than Earl Pardini would show up each year to lead a school-wide square dance. And on this particular evening, I'd come to find out that it was another grade school that introduced Earl Pardini to square dancing about 75 years ago.
Well, my name is Earl Pardini. You might be very surprised to hear this, but I grew up in the Bronx. I went to public school 68, and we learned how to do Darling Nellie Gray in the second grade. And it's all history from then.
By the little cottage door, where lived my darling Nellie Gray.
I moved up to Big Indian in 1962, and at that time I wasn't playing fiddle. I didn't start playing the fiddle until about 1970, I think. I played accordion, and actually, day after tomorrow is the anniversary of my first accordion lesson, which was in 1950. I got a kick out of it myself when I think about it.
Accordion was a big deal back then.
Yeah, it was. We had an accordion orchestra in grade school. There was about 10 of us or 11 of us. It was really very popular. And then I kind of put it in the closet, and I've been playing again for a long, long time. But I didn't forget anything, and I still love playing it now, and actually I play more than I ever did.
How'd you learn how to call?
Faking it. You know, going to square dances, hearing other people call, and then, you know, I just had nerve enough to try it one day.
And the ladies turn out and the dance back in. And the dance turn out and the ladies in. Now take them home, girls. Take them back to your home place and swing.
We did a lot of dances around the time of the bicentennial. Square dancing could be really popular. Actually, I think that summer of the bicentennial, I played dances at least two or three nights a week through the whole summer. And by the time the summer was over, I really didn't want to look at my fiddle. You know, it kind of burned me out. Since then, you know, here and there, you know, it's gotten popular again now lately. We've had more interest in it in the last 2 years than we've had in quite a while. Dane Scudder is more of a traditionalist than I am. I kind of wing it in a lot of ways. You know, I add things to the dance that aren't normally there. Dane knows a lot of the tradition We got from Hilton Kelly, who was a prominent square dance caller and fiddler from over around Fleischmann's.
Dane Scudder just happened to be an arm's length away from me, so of course we spoke with him and learned about Hilton Kelly, who passed down all those Catskill square dance traditions.
Dane Scudder, from originally from Fleischmann's, New York and Delaware County, had a dairy farm in Hawkett Center. So it was a fifth-generation dairy farm, and we grew up with Hilton Kelly, who provided all the square dance music years ago, and I've learned his calls and his music. And we have another band called the Tremperskill Boys in Delaware County that we do a lot of square dancing, all Hilton's calls. So that's traditional Delaware County square dance music. Yeah.
And the calls are a signature of a person or a type of square dancing?
It's a type of square dancing. It was very popular after World War II. Earl, for example, used to call square dances almost every night of the week, and so did Hilton. It was very popular in the 40s and 50s and 60s, and slowly waned down. But it's a cultural, it's not just New York State. Their square dancing is all over the United States, really. But this is Catskill Mountain. This is what I play. It's Catskill Mountain fiddling and square dancing.
On the other side of the barn, Olivia spoke with folklorist Ginny Shear, whose organization is doing its part to foster traditional Catskill square dancing.
I run a group called Catskills Folk Connection, and one of our main programs is sponsoring square dances, Eastern traditional square dances. Dane Scudder, who's here tonight playing the banjo, plays the fiddle, and he said, when I was getting ready to go to college, the only live music I really remember hearing was Hilt Kelly and the Sidekicks. And I said, oh, good, you're a tradition bearer. When this was a total farming area, and, 90% of the people farmed, when the farmer took the milk to the creamery, she might say to the people she met at the creamery who were also dropping off their milk, we're going to have a fiddler at our farm this Saturday. Come on over after you finish milking. And so people would get there. First ones that got there would move the furniture out on the porch or even on the lawn. They put the fiddler between the two front rooms and dance until midnight. The kids all came. And I don't know if it's true in your family, but if you were having a big Thanksgiving dinner, for example, and it was cold and people arrived with lots of coats, you'd have them go upstairs and put them on the beds in the bedroom. Well, that's where the kids would go, and they'd snuggle down, and they'd sleep until they either smelled dinner or they figured out, because the fiddle stopped, that it was time to, there would be a cold, kind of cold supper at midnight, and people who lived far away would get going, and others would stay and dance some more, and everybody went home and milked the cows again. But that's how deep the tradition was here. It came from the quadrilles that arrived in the 19th century, kind of put the cotillion out of business, though there are some elements of cotillion in our square dances. Some areas were hit by the quadrille and didn't switch to it, like New England stayed with the line dances. But the Catskills were all about squares, and it's a very deep tradition.
And so I asked Dane Scudder,
do you think this tradition will continue?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Our other band, the Tremperskill Boys, we're trying to enlist younger people to play with us, and we haven't had much luck yet. But we have young people, dancing. They're very good tonight, and we just need some of those people to take an interest in music. And it's the kind of thing you almost need to have somebody in your family that plays it, or a friend in the community that can be a mentor, because ordinarily you wouldn't be exposed to this average person. But it's a lot of fun.
Helen Chase's sister Alice would agree. She comes up every year from Maryland to reunite with the family and to carry on the tradition.
I'm Alice Chase Robeson. My husband and I live in Maryland. I'm the youngest of the five children of Sherry and Kenny Chase. My parents bought this house in 72, and Thanksgiving, we've always had a square dance after Thanksgiving. But until Earl became part of our lives, Earl Pardini, we used records
When you square dance now, what kind of memories does that bring back?
I have a son who's 46 and a daughter who's 39. And just like the children who are here right now, I had them on my shoulders and they just held me tight. And I would go through all the do-si-do and swing your partner and whatever the call was. And they just had a hoot.
Back home to the ladies' home place and swing them high.
This is a private affair, but if someone were to befriend you, Helen.
Yes, and that happens. I might meet somebody yesterday and invite them to the square dance today.
So if you want to be here next year, get a hold of Helen Chase. Be friendly to her.
Now find your own true love. And the ladies turn out and the gents turn in.
We were just talking about the incredible sliding scale between transplants, weekenders, seasonal folks, folks who just come for a BME on the weekend, and real tourists who just drive through, right? Square dancing is a good way for people to meet each other and to smooth the interactions between incomers, which is what I call them, or longtime residents. And if they can get along on the dance floor, it's probably a good thing.
And with that, Olivia and I joined hands for a Weave the Ring dance to Will the Circle Be Unbroken, led by none other than Earl Pardini. I wondered aloud if this experience was atypical for a production internship, and Olivia responded that every one of her Catskills experiences has been more or less atypical. For CatsCast, the Catskills podcast, and WJFF, Radio Catskill, I'm Brett Barry. Happy New Year, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks to Brett for putting a smile on our face there to end the year. And, of course, you can hear all of the CatsCast, Catskills podcast episodes at catscast.com. That's KAATSCAST.com. Got it. Before we go, we want to introduce you to a new voice you'll hear on Radio Catskill in 2025, the new Capital News Bureau reporter for the New York Public News Network. It's Jungyeon Han. She starts this week covering the action in Albany, and she brings a wealth of experience reporting for national and local public radio on politics and policy. Veronica Volk with the New York Public News Network caught up with Han about her plans for the position.
In a lot of ways, it's a homecoming for me.
Jungyeon Han is from Syracuse and got her start in professional journalism at WAMC in Albany. After that, she worked for NPR Weekend Edition in D.C., New Hampshire Public Radio in Concord, and then NPR again, on the road in various swing states covering the presidential election.
And it was really fun to talk with voters across the country about the different issues that they cared about and thinking about politics from a voter's first perspective. And I wanted to keep doing that after the election.
Former Albany Bureau Chief Karen DeWitt retired last year, and Han says she knows she has big shoes to fill.
It's hard to think of all of the respect, knowledge, connections, credibility that she's gained. That's hard to replicate at all.
Han starts at a pivotal moment for the state government, but ultimately she says she's looking forward to the challenge.
I am really excited at the opportunity to cover the state because, like Karen, this is my state. I love it dearly. It's a real honor to do this job, and I can't wait to get started.
In Rochester, I'm Veronica Volk for the New York Public News Network.
And we look forward to hearing Jungyeon's reports from Albany. We'll bring you those in the new year. And we look forward to bringing you more local news, culture, and NPR in the new year. Thank you so much for supporting us this year and for listening. I'm Tim Bruno. Happy New Year.
Support comes from Jeff Bank, Sullivan County's community bank, celebrating 110 years of service this year, offering deposit and loan products for all your banking needs. Member FDIC and an equal housing lender. National Mortgage Licensing System and Registry Identification Number 405318. Jeff Bank. Still banking strong. And support comes from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Bradley Cooper, welcome to Fresh Air.
Tina Fey, welcome.
Brian Cranston, welcome.
Sarah Silverman,
Karl Rove,
Hillary Clinton,
Stephen Sondheim,
Robert Redford,
Lena Dunham, welcome to
welcome.
Fresh
welcome
Air.
Welcome to Fresh Air.
Listen to Fresh Air Monday through Thursday at 2 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville. From river to river, mountain to mountain, we are Radio Catskill.